You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Zachary.
Hi, Robert.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good. You're always doing good. You're an optimist. And in fact, one thing we're going to argue about is whether optimism or pessimism is in order in this crazy world of ours right now. But first, let's introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Zachary Carabel. Why don't you mention a couple of books you've written?
Couple of books. I did a book called The Leading Indicators, which was about how we invented our economic numbers like GDP and unemployment and inflation, you know, numbers that we made up. I did a book about Muslim, Christian, and Jewish coexistence called Peace Be Upon You.
Yeah, good book. That was not long after 9/11 when a book like that was quite in order. Am I right?
I mean, it felt long after, but in retrospect, it was. It came out in 2008, so it was long enough. I'm going to shut this window back here so we don't get this glare.
Okay.
And then I did a book on the U.S. presidential election of 1948 about television and politics called The Last Campaign. I did a book about sustainable business practices, which I co-authored with Aaron Kramer, called Sustainable Excellence. There's a whole bunch out there.
Superfusion,
about the Chinese and American convergence economically in the late 1990s, but mostly in the 2000s.
Okay.
And of course, that's an interesting question today as to whether they are now diverging. Or whether
and bears on the question of how optimistic we should be in this seemingly zany world of ours. But before we get to that, all of that, quickly, you write for a number of places and show up on cable news and stuff, right?
Yeah, I write for Wired. I write for Politico. I write for the Washington Post opinion column occasionally. And then I write for, you know, most places that most people would know. And over the past year, I've been on Fox Business News for this hour-long show with some regularity, trying to add a different note, I guess for them, playing the liberal on Fox Business News, but definitely presenting a different point of view to the amen chorus in the belief that whether or not anyone's listening, we have to keep trying to talk to each other about our differences and our views. And, you know... I don't know if anyone's listening or not. I certainly don't know when I know watches, but I know that there are a lot of people who do watch.
And it's a job somebody's got to do, Zachary, and they haven't asked me to do it, so it might as well be you. You would be my designated alternate.
Your designated alternate. It's good to know.
And then also, I mean, this is maybe did this lead to this conversation? The fact that you have, I think, you're instrumental in setting up this thing in collaboration with New America, formerly called the New America Foundation, that gets together a number of thinkers. And I think ostensibly the idea is that they are optimists. And that's why when they got in touch with me and asked me to be part of it, I said, like, are you sure you've got the right Robert Wright? Has there been a mistake?
Yeah, but, no, that's always a problem with a name like Robert.
Or maybe am I to that site what you are to Fox Business News?
It's an interesting question. So it's called the Progress Network. We're doing this conversation in early January of 2020. It is not yet live, although there are about 50 people who have said that they want to be a part of this. And yeah, it's an effort to bring together people who have a sensibility, I think, less of optimism. We're in this moment culturally where optimism has a bad name, ironic but true. And it's not a collection of individuals who think everything is great, right? It's a collection of individuals who believe that we don't focus enough on the efforts of a lot of people who are solving problems that are real, or that we don't focus enough, a la someone like Steven Pinker, on evidence that things are better than we think. But it is not endorsing any of these views per se. It's simply saying we lack a collective voice that suggests a different future, and I guess a different present than the current kind of cacophony of pessimism and negative.
Well, I can see that you could well have two different kinds of people on such a site, because you mentioned on the one hand solving problems that are real, and on the other hand people like Steve Pinker, who, not that he's against solving problems that are real or hasn't even contributed to that, but he's known for emphasizing the positive. And my problem with spending too much emphasizing the positive is then actual real problems are in danger of getting neglected or downplayed.
Well, look, there are two things I would say about this. One is to shamelessly borrow from like Karl Popper and also a theoretical physicist, David Deutsch, who's an English physicist.
Mm-hmm.
Optimism is not the conviction that the future is going to be better or that the present is great. It is the humility to know that those things, the future in particular, is unwritten, and that we are in the present responsible for writing it. Mm-hmm. And that each of us have a hand, or potentially, I guess, have a hand in writing that future that is inherently unknown. And so having an open and somewhat humble approach to uncertain future outcomes is a more constructive point to start with than pessimism, which in many ways is the conviction that things are bad and getting worse.
Yeah, although I would say that the way a lot of people take Steve Pinker's book, and I'm not saying that this is the right way to take it, but is as itself having, in a sense, a lack of humility. They take it to be saying kind of, hey, things are pretty good. We can figure out how, you know, there are issues. We'll deal with them. And so that is, I think, taken to be, not quite complacency or self-satisfaction, but something close enough to those things to represent a lack of humility. In other words, I mean, any confident prediction sure. about the future lacks humility, right? Whether right. it's positive or negative.
Correct. And again, I'm not, I'm trying to bring together people with somewhat disparate voices and also different temperaments. So I'm not in this pure thing, the Progress Network, which is separate from my own particular perspective. I accept the fact that there are different people of different temperaments. Some are more outspokenly certain of their beliefs, and some are more skeptical and more unclear. Again, if you're going to get 50 relatively cogent, verbal, interesting, intelligent people together, it's unlikely you're going to have an amen chorus, and that's all for the best. Mm-hmm. I just think that, you know, a lot of this is our news culture. A lot of this is our human nature, right? We are somewhat predisposed to be highly attuned to dangers and risks. We're not nearly as disposed generally to see what else might be going on. And news has always been, and certainly in our lifetimes and before, that if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. It highlights strong emotions, hot emotions, not cool emotions. And we live in a political climate, both in the United States and increasingly globally, where the hot, right, anger, outrage, resentment is the coin of the realm, and that's kind of the way it is, but that doesn't mean that that encompasses human experience, nor are we necessarily well served by those tones in the way in which we think about what problems do we have, how do we solve them, how do we address them, who is addressing them, how are you addressing them. I mean, Jim and mm-hmm. Deborah Fallows, for instance, have gone around the country and kind of looked at a lot of small communities that are supposed to be on the verge of collapse and looked at what people are doing in those communities to recreate, reinvent. Some of that might fail, but they're there, right? And we ought to be paying more attention to those stories, but that's a different kind of energy, a different kind of tone than we're on the brink of war or we're on the brink of collapse.
Speaking of which, we are on the brink of war. Not something you should laugh about. As we tape this, and it won't air immediately, but at the moment we're taping it, you know, President Trump had an Iranian, a very, very prominent Iranian assassinated, and that has led to ominous developments. We don't know how this is going to play out. Could well be bad in any number of ways. And right. I would just so I would say a couple of things. And this has all happened since you and I decided to talk about this stuff. And I must say, I mean, this development actually embodies many of the very forces that I've been worried about. So it's like it doesn't, in a sense, surprise me. And I don't just mean that, like, I've been saying, like everyone else, Trump is like this dangerous, slightly clueless, intemperate guy. I mean a couple of things. I mean, one way to look, I mean, the first question is, how did Trump get elected? And he got elected by virtue of the fact that even as a number of people were singing the praises of globalization, and I sang some of those praises in my book, Non-Zero, and have sung some of them. And I would say you and I are in some ways on the same wavelength. I think we believe that globalization is in some fundamental sense a good thing in any event. The forces behind it are so inexorable. We got to learn how to steer it. We're not going to stop it. And I think you and I think that economic engagement between nations is a good thing, is a pacifying thing even. But at the same time, people who are uncritically singing the praises of globalization, we're missing the fact that a lot of people are, not only are not so thrilled with it, but actively resent what they take to be results of it. And some of those people got Trump elected. So there was this simmering discontent that I think some of the more blithe optimists were just missing, and it would have behooved us to pay attention to it. I mean, that's not the only force that, I think is manifest in this latest crisis, but it's one of them, right? I mean,
and that's where the it rhymes with Poland, and it rhymes with Great Britain, and it rhymes with Brazil, where I just got back from, and it rhymes from Indonesia and this kind of global movement toward, hey, wait a minute, right? All this rosy future that we're creating, this utopian vision of connectivity fueled by technology and, you know, the end of war and the end of the Cold War, you name it, has left a lot of people expecting more and getting less. Let's just dial back though for a moment. I think that, you know, the challenge around narratives and stories, and I'm not trying to be like academic about this, is we have a view of the world that is often framed much the way sportscasters talk about games, right? So two teams are tied, 10 seconds left. So, you know, football, it was football playoffs this weekend. Quarterback throws, interception, game is over. 10 minutes later, every news story in the world talks about how that team that just lost, all of its flaws were exposed, and, you know, they clearly were sloppy, and you should have seen this coming, and all
my,
these.
The term is Monday morning quarterback, which I take it you're about to apply beyond football.
Right, because if it had gone the other way in that one moment, you would have had a plethora of column lengths saying, oh my God, you know, look how good they were in the clinch, and at that very moment, all their character showed through and how good they were. You know, Trump is elected in the United States by what? 60,000 votes, 100, whatever it was. It's a razor's edge difference. And, you know, to think that the country was fundamentally X on November 1st, 2016, and then suddenly it was fundamentally Y a week later is part of the problem, right? Everything you're talking about, or everything we now talk about, all of those realities were percolating and present. They may not have been as prominent, you know, they may not have the ratio between what was intensively present versus not so present might have been different, but everything was there. And in the United States in particular, we have a really incredible ability to rapidly forget who we are and tell ourselves some sort of comforting story. You know, Watergate is now cast as this moment when American democracy worked and everybody came together and did the right thing, and ding dong, the witch is dead. We got rid of the tyrant, and this shows the strength of our constitutional system, without recognizing all the contingencies of that moment and all the time it took and all the vagaries. You know, I quoted once talking about, I was fascinated by this to look back on it, right? We tell the story of the McCarthy era in the United States as this fever, this intense fever where we were all persecuting anybody who was any way connected to communism. And then there's this Army McCarthy hearings, and the council gets up and says, have you no shame, Senator, have you no shame? And the fever breaks and McCarthy's discredited. And then he's a raving alcoholic on the floor of the Senate. His committee is stripped from him, and he's dead a year later. But, you know, his Gallup ratings in the fall, when he's a raving alcoholic, when people are asked, do you support and believe Senator McCarthy, was close to 30%. It was down from 65%. But it didn't go from 65% to zero.
Right.
So all these things were there.
And they never entirely disappeared.
And we somehow, I guess we believed, and I was trying to investigate my own thought of these things, that somehow just with enough economic growth and enough progress and enough globalization or change, all these things would just kind of fade. They would just fade away. You know, all the dark angels of our nature would just dissipate over time. And that was the problem too.
Yeah.
It's the problem today too, because now we're convinced of, you know, the flip side, right? We're through the looking glass now in the way we talk.
Yeah.
About.
Well, yeah. And we should say, I mean, you know, there, a lot of good has come from globalization, notably a serious reduction of poverty in vast swaths of the world. But we now appreciate more that another thing that's been entailed is growing income inequality within nations. And that's why I'd say two things in response to your, well, kind of Trump only barely won. He might not have won. Well, right. But first of all, as you said, this is happening in a lot of countries. If Trump hadn't won, you would still have right-wing nationalist, let's say ethno-nationalist movements in various countries. It's not always, you know, they have some left-wing elements, notably, the one, motivated by, discussed with income inequality, right? Some of the policy prescriptions there are left-wing. But, so let's just call it ethno-nationalism. But A, it isn't just America. B, if I had told you 10 years ago that a guy like Donald Trump, that there was so much discontent out there that Donald Trump could be elected by president, if barely, even barely, I think you would have said I was crazy. I think I would have said I was crazy. I just don't, and I think all of this suggests that the forces we're talking about are A, deep and fundamental, and B, we really weren't paying attention. And see, anyone who was just singing the praises of globalization uncritically would have been doing us a disservice.
Right. And I guess I would have said at the time, and I believe I did, but I'm sure one could look through things I've written or things I've said that look foolish in retrospect. You know, I wrote a piece, I think, in 2008 for the Financial Times about how mounting levels of debt were not necessarily a problem for the economy. And you know, granted, debt has continued to mount, so I'm not so sure that that was wrong, but clearly an aspect of the way debt was structured in 2008 was part of the collapse of 2008. So, you know, you can look back at that and go, hey, idiot, look at what you wrote here. Mm-hmm. Although in the, you know, in the greater scheme, there's still some real truth in that. I think though that, you know, the reality is anybody who thinks that human beings are not capable at any given moment and human societies are not good at any given moment from colossally going off the rails in ways that are either foolish or massively destructive is missing something essential about either human history or human nature. So I take as an axiom that at any given moment, everything could fall apart in ways that are rapid, breathtakingly destructive and will be looked back on, assuming there'll be people to look back on it as one of those, oh my God, how did that happen moments, which is why we're constantly looking at July of 1914 and we're constantly trying to find the seeds of destruction in past examples where that happened and transpose them today and think about, okay, is this similar? But, you know, if you do too much of that, you also miss the fact that history is in fact a litany of things that went wrong more than it's a litany of things that went right, because things going wrong create drama. You know, the Tolstoy, there are no novels about a happy family. Why? Because there's no story in a happy family. There's no drama. There's no tragedy. There's no change. So, you know, we can overdo that and we can overdo it in the present. You know, Trump politics, all these right wing stuff, they are a phenomenon of the present. They are not the phenomenon of the present. And there are varying degrees of it, right? I mean, we could get into this for, I'm sure, hours and hours and hours that right wing nationalism as a trope is familiar globally. Its manifestation ends up feeling very different place to place. And I don't believe that what's going on in the United States right now is so similar to what's going on in Poland, even if there are similarities, you know, because we have a 200-year-old democracy, they have a 20-year-old democracy. Same thing in Brazil, you know, they had a military dictatorship in the 1970s. Bolsonaro might be an evil dude, might be. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not a Brazil expert. I just travel there, which means I get to say something. But he ain't kissing the spider woman. He's not doing what the military government was doing in the 60s and 70s. People are not being rounded up and tortured. I mean, yes, they've been killed in the favelas. My point being, there are global themes that are real and challenges that are real that I think indeed were somewhat created by globalization and technology. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only story.
Okay, but I guess my question is, it seems to be kind of clear what can come from highlighting problems. It can focus people's attention on solving them. What good comes from the other thing? In other words, part of Steve Pinker's complaint, and again, this is no, we shouldn't pick on him, but he's just naturally iconic here, I think, you know, and I've written, we can link to the piece I wrote about, his book in Wired. He's a super smart guy. There's a lot of things I like about the book. But just using it as a way to raise the question, what is the upside of, I mean, Steve seems to think there is some downside to not appreciating how in many ways wonderful things are. Actually, maybe I understand what he he's worried about is derailing some of the things that he thinks are responsible for the positive. For example, trade among nations, or he would say probably a faith in reason that leads to technological progress, although I think we're all aware these days of the downsides of certain technological developments. I mean, is that your answer? Is it that, like, is that why you have a certain kind of sympathy with his project, which is that you're worried? What are you worried about, a leftist reaction?
Well, let's you pick someone different, right? Because Pinker is part of this, but he's also controversial. Someone like Jim and Deb Fallows, who are friends of mine, who just went in. Mm-hmm. Look, there are a lot of stories here that are underreported because they take a while. They're more subtle, and they're just about people trying to solve problems locally, right? Who are not looking to Washington, who don't even really expect much from the center. They expect much from their own lives. And you can do those stories in villages in Brazil. You could do those stories in, you know, communities throughout India, mm-hmm. all of which are grappling with similar issues that we are. So one is, does one believe that a societal belief in its collective capacity to solve problems is in and of itself a needed ingredient in effectively solving those problems, right? So fatalistic societies, pessimistic societies, societies that essentially feel it's all going to get worse, as well as individuals, I would posit, I can't prove this, right? We don't get to replay the tape, have a much harder time galvanizing collective energies to solve needed issues. In part because, look, if you really believe that the world is on the verge of kind of pseudo-planetary extinction because of climate change, as well as political extinction because of the political climate, and that that's a likely outcome and that the future is going to be worse, that does rationally at an individual and national level lead to a kind of a beggar thy neighbor tendency, right? Because if everything's getting worse, if the pie's shrinking, if everything's going to get more and more dog-eat-dog, in a Hobbesian world, you do tend toward self-protection / short-term /
Well, maybe, but the people spending most time sounding the alarm about climate change don't profess to want that. They profess to want nations to do the smart thing and cooperate in doing it.
Right, and again, I mean, I'm in no way suggesting
that. And wouldn't you agree not enough energy seems to be focused on that problem in an effective way through the political machinery we have?
Yeah, but I mean, again, there are people who are saying, look, this is a pressing issue that we need to deal with, and we need to either find technology solutions or political solutions, and are investing accordingly. There are a lot of people doing that, and they're kind of going about it with passion and intensity. That's a little bit different than we're on the verge of.
Yeah, but the U.S. government, the biggest and most influential player in this realm, is currently more or less of the official belief that this isn't even a problem.
Correct, but the U.S. government
that's
is
a big problem.
Yes, but the U.S. government is also one actor amongst many. So, as well as anybody that in the United States, one of the most interesting things that's going to go on right now is this looming gestating conflict between the state of California and the federal government mm-hmm. about whether or not the state of California can set things like CAFE, fuel emission standards, and environmental policy. Because the state of California on its own is whatever sixth or seventh largest single economy in the world. It's a massive portion of the United States. And it essentially does set certain policies, which means that any business or anybody dealing with California, which is basically everybody, right? There's no auto supply chains that sell to the United States, ex-California, and then California, have to essentially abide by those standards, which means all of the efforts of the Trump administration to undermine a lot of these things are themselves countered by and offset by California's ability to set standards that essentially become national. And that's why the federal government is now suing California. Mm-hmm. But the point being, all the efforts of the federal government, this huge, powerful, as you just pointed out, entity, are not successfully rolling things back nearly commensurate with the outrage and fear about its policies, because there are these structural impediments. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration, very early in the term, because it could get rid of certain Obama era things. There's a clause within laws that you can undo regulations passed in the past 6 months of the prior administration to sort of prevent mm-hmm. the dead hand. So they rolled back limits on offshore drilling, which the Obama administration had put in toward the end of 2016. There hasn't been any more offshore drilling because there's no economic incentive for it.
And okay, there's that. But as for the California initiatives, I would suggest that, and I'm not an expert on California politics, that the California's government was acting partly in response to political forces marshaled by people who are going around screaming the world is falling apart. These alarmists are a lot of them are political activists, you know, and I mean, we don't need to go back and forth on this forever,
you
I guess.
Raise the interesting question of back to the question you posit, right? What harm is done by saying, hey, the house is on fire, we need to do something now?
Right, right.
As opposed to the potential harm, I suppose you're suggesting, of saying, hey, look at all the good things that are going on. Does that engender either complacency, denial, or not successfully galvanize action to deal with problems? And I'm saying flip that on its head, which is there's a lot of evidence that human beings in a position of both panic and fear and anger are not the most effective at dealing with the problems because everything gets heightened. It's like when you're in a heightened state, it's not usually the best climate to solve issues.
What's an example right now where excessive alarm seems to be what's getting in the way of solving a problem?
Look, I could say very controversial that I think a lot of the hysteria about Trump is hysteria about Trump rather than things that have been done. Now, this is a good philosophical question. I have an opinion, you have an opinion, everyone has an opinion whether words and the words that we use are fundamental to the world that we live in. You know, you and I are both writers, so you'd think we think that it's fundamental. I'm a little more skeptical about the relationship between words and actions in any immediate sense, particularly when it comes to a structure whereby we live in the United States, at least, where you can basically say anything. We think that that's a good thing, but the saying of it doesn't really necessarily translate into the doing of it. My perception from the time Trump was elected is that he has said and expressed a lot of, you know, morally vile things, but that the structures of our society to date, you know, I reserve the right to change my mind tomorrow, have proven far more resilient to that in terms of actual action, that there is a huge gap between the reaction to this individual's words versus his deeds. And, you know, I just pointed out the EPA stuff. These were actions taken, but they were actions without effect, right? Raising offshore drilling regulations, saying, I'm going to bring back coal, opening up Anwar, the Alaska wilderness, aggressively pursuing the pipeline through North Dakota. You know, other than the pipeline, which was basically, you know, was being done under Obama and which Hillary Clinton expressed support for, if we remember, that was one of her campaigns. Very little of these actions, let alone these words, have translated into a massive shift in U.S. environmental policy. And you can say, well, if he's got elected again 4 more years, who knows? That may be true. But it behooves us to actually look at what is happening versus what we fear is happening versus what is being said.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love a guest who gives me a chance to plug my newsletter, which is the and your reference to overreaction to Trump is the perfect excuse for that. So the newsletter is the Non-Zero newsletter. You can sign up for it free at nonzero.org. But before it was called the Non-Zero newsletter, it was called the Mindful Resistance newsletter. You know, I wrote a book about Buddhist meditation. That was the mindful part, and the resistance part was a reference to Trump. And the genesis of the newsletter was my conviction that people were overreacting to Trump, not in the sense, and maybe here you and I disagree, not in the sense of misgauging the magnitude of the threat he poses, but in the sense of being so reactive to him in opposing him that they were often playing into his hands. I mean, half of what he does is just troll people.
Right.
And he trolls them in ways that wind up energizing his own base when they react.
Right. So on that, I would say there were far more effective ways to undermine, defeat, push back, both Trump as an individual and the forces that he represents, mm-hmm. as opposed to the path that has been taken, which locks us, I think, into an ever deepening spiral. And this is not like the Civil War, right? There's no slavery, like, meaning Trump is a sensibility and a potential. He's not a system. Slavery was a system, right? So, I mean, I'm simply anticipating a pushback could be, oh, were you just saying, would I have been the guy in 1856? Saying, you know, it's okay if the South is enslaving human beings. Let's just let it be. I'm not suggesting that about Trump. I'm suggesting that words are different than actions, and potential is different than reality, right? The fact that in the right circumstances, all these things might be true, doesn't make them true. It makes them potentially true. And I think how one reacts to potential versus reality are rather different. You know, you react to the potential of fire somewhat differently than you react to your house.
Okay. But it seems to me he has done some real kinds of damage and also demonstrated the power of some genuinely alarming popular sentiments, and demonstrated the ability of a certain kind of politician to marshal them. And this is, I think, the second chance to plug something called Non-Zero. But this is not my newsletter. It's my book, which came out in 2000. And by the way, is sometimes characterized as, it recently was somewhere, as a kind of icon of naive cheerleading for globalization or neoliberalism or something. But I considered that a misreading at the time. And in fact, in between the hardcover and the paperback, even, I rewrote the introduction to make sure there was no misunderstanding. My point was, on balance, history clearly has a direction. People are playing. Technology allows people to play non-zero-sum games at greater and greater different distances. Globalization is in some ways a culmination to date of that. But there are huge epic downturns, and B, it's pretty clear what could lead to one now. And I identified that as, well, among other things, a failure to nurture global governance in ways that solve international non-zero-sum problems that aren't naturally solved by the market and aren't naturally solved by individual governments acting on their own. Okay. Yeah. So that included environmental problems, weapons control, problems, and it included, economic problems. And I've long thought that, and this speaks to the issue of, the problem of, income inequality within nations. I've long thought that, and argued that, there is such a thing as left-wing global governance. There is such a thing as trade agreements that have labor and environmental accords, and that have labor accords that could insulate not entirely insulate, but somewhat dull the impact on workers, low-skill workers in developed economies like ours. I have a real concern about global governance going unnurtured. And a couple of things about Trump. A, he is adamantly against it, at least nominally, and maybe some of this may just be words, as you say, but he just denounces global governance. He has, as you know, finally gotten to the point of essentially paralyzing the adjudication mechanism of the World Trade Organization, which was one of its great accomplishments. Yep. He refused, as often is the case in these global bodies, for better or worse, the U.S. has disproportionate power. He refused to permit new judges to take the place of judges who are being rotated out from the appeals panel in the WTO. So now it's dead. And the one great thing about the WTO, which was solving trade disputes without trade wars, is permanent right now, the time being, on hold. B, weapons control. You know, the Iran nuclear deal was, in my view, something that added to the confidence that Iran would indeed abide by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it is a party to. Trump just ditched it.
Right.
These are real things he's done, and moreover, he has demonstrated the power of certain kinds of popular sentiment or populist sentiments.
On the first one, right, the trade one.
Yep.
There's a difference between, Trump exposing flaws that are harmful within the United States that are going to do us harm versus a world order deteriorating, because, TPP was passed. It just doesn't include us. It includes a considerable portion of East Asia.
I'm not even saying I'm pro TPP. That's not an example I use. But anyway,
they have a very robust dispute mechanism that was built into it. They have multilateral trade mechanisms in which to adjudicate this amongst themselves, the Japanese, the Koreans, with the Thais and the Vietnamese and the Australians, Chileans. I mean, I don't remember all the individual countries in the TPP. So you know, we might be doing ourselves a lot of harm. That may be different than doing the world a lot of harm. The world actually may be much better off from creating these connections that don't all circle through Washington. The global governance issues, right? I mean, I did a piece about 2 months ago stating my view that nothing Trump has done is in any way nearly as harmful as multiple things that were done under George W. Bush, between invading Iraq and however many hundreds of thousands of people got killed, but an entire ecosystem that was stable and flawed for one that was unstable and even more flawed. And we're paying the price of that today. I mean, part of what's going on between Iran and our own continual heated stuff is the effluvia of the Iraq war, metadata spying, torture in Guantanamo, torture in Abu Ghraib. And if you're going to talk about global governance, look, the drone warfare under Obama's first administration, which was essentially the United States saying we reserve the right to assassinate our enemies from afar, which is exactly how Soleimani was killed. We're talking about this on January 6, 2020. He was killed on Friday, right? The third. Same.
Iraq time. Yes. Thursday evening, our time. Yeah.
But it's a legacy of the drone warfare. And I'm not saying Obama is responsible for that. I'm just saying we killed a lot of people in Yemen and elsewhere and in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, it's not as if we were just tootling along honoring these.
No, absolutely. On the other hand, I could turn that around and say, well, look, if all of the last three presidents have done these horrible things, shouldn't I be worried? I mean,
be less worried about the current individual who is president and more worried about a system that's enabled that, right? I think what we should.
So in other words, the downward slope is no steeper than it was 10 years ago. That's the way I would be.
Occupied by someone who is more ungovernable as an individual in a system that has empowered that in ways that should never have happened in a democracy. We should know, you know, the continual cessation of congressional authority to the presidency, along with a somewhat imperial state, that's what we should have been paying attention to. And a bunch of us have been saying this for years, right? You should have been paying attention to the agglomeration of powers in the executive office, which create the danger that everybody's always aware of in a democracy, that you elect someone who is unsuited or unsuitable and therefore has all these powers unsuitably.
At the same time, the congressional machinery seems to be pretty gunked up. So it's like, you know, it's basically democracy is just not working. And in a certain sense, the way it increasingly does, quote, work in the sense of getting policy initiatives done is through what you and I probably agree is an abuse of executive power. Yeah. That's a really bad place to be when Congress can't do any, you know, Congress almost never does anything wise, and presidents take the initiative in ways that wind up being concerning.
And there's also a lot going on in both our country and multiple countries that is neither impinged by nor influenced by nor ever was shaped by decisions made at the center. So, you know, we have two things going on. We have too much power at the center. And that's true in every country, right? That's a media thing. Every world leader has a level of celebrity and power that was simply not true, you know, 100 years ago. You could still walk up to Wilson's White House in 1918 and wait, you know, for an audience. 10 Downing Street was just a nice house on number 10 on Downing Street. There wasn't concrete barriers and stormtroops on either side of it with helicopters. So we have that, right? We have this kind of intense focus on the center. But part of the problem with that focus on the center is it makes it seem that every decision that's made in the center is in fact everything that's going on and not part of what's going on, that there is a spectrum of realities here. You know, part of what I've been trying to say for years is, and why I wrote that book, The Leading Indicators, which seems like a very dry book about statistics, and I think it was actually a kind of interesting one, is that the need that we have to make sweeping statements about who we are at any given moment is part of the problem. You know, because the United States alone is 328 million people. We are no statement. There is no statement that's going to encapsulate back to what I talked about earlier of, the game goes one way and suddenly the team is, you know, incredible and resilient and tough. The game goes the other way and suddenly all their flaws are exposed. There's no nuance in that. There's no spectrum of truths. There's no multiple stories that are each true simultaneously, right? I was saying during the financial crisis and afterwards, you could say 80 million people in the United States were completely screwed. Screwed economically, screwed in terms of security, screwed in terms of jobs. You could also say 100 million people were doing pretty well and 15 million people were doing obscenely well or really well. All those things can actually be true at the same time. But we don't have a way of embracing, you know, we seem to be able to hold these truths as being self-evident, but we don't seem to be able to hold multiple truths simultaneously as being self-evident. I think that's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, you said, I think you're right. In some ways, there's been a centralization of power, but I'd say in not all. And I think this, the decentralizing forces are in their own way concerning, just in the sense that they're changing the game so rapidly that we're having trouble adapting. So, for example, Trump is in some ways a representation of the decentralization of power. The Republican Party elites, like the Democratic Party elites, have much less power than they did. They did not want him to be the nominee.
Right.
But we're in a world where a guy can get on a reality show and then use social media to become president, which I find kind of alarming. And you know, you can go back and forth on what the centralizing forces are, what the decentralizing forces are. But what seems clear to me, and in a way this is at the core of all my concerns, is that the very technology that's bringing us a lot of good things, breakthroughs in, you know, medical breakthroughs, allowing people to communicate with relatives across the seas, all the good stuff, are collectively changing things so rapidly that I just worry about our capacity to respond wisely to the change. In fact, in my book Non-Zero, there's a subhead in some chapter that says, slow globalization down. And what I said there isn't literally just throw a wrench into the works. I just said, when people complain that the cost of adding, say, labor environmental accords to trade agreements is to reduce the global GDP by 0.01% or whatever it would be, so what? It's like, if it, and correspondingly, and to actually slow technological progress probably to some extent by dulling incentives for that, I'm like, maybe that's good. Maybe things are moving too fast for us to respond wisely to. And that is part of my concern. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's, you know, the trope of technology has fundamentally changed something. And even there, you know, I look, every time there's a new technology, human beings seem to have very similar reactions about the disintegration of the old order in the face of a new order that is inherently worse or chaotic or problematic, or unleashing genies that had been effectively bottled until time. And you can go through reactions to Gutenberg, to radio, to television, to phones, and some of the concerns are like insert technology here and are no different, but we act like Facebook and the connectivity and the immediacy and the micro targeting to different groups has eroded and changed the nature of democracy. And then I look back at pamphleting in the 1790s, right? Or yellow journalism in the 1890s. And yeah. I think it's worth looking at, are those really so different? People were agitated. They were misinformed. There was fake news, real fake news in the case of the Pulitzer Papers in the 1890s, and hysteria, right? And bonds seeming to fray, or the Dreyfus Affair in France. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to think of something that technology today is commensurately worse than the Dreyfus Affair. And that may not mean something to us in the United States, but you know, anybody who learned French history or who's French and thinks about the 1790s, a period where it seemed like literally on the verge of civil war, a lot of it was fueled by newspapers, right? This was rumors and innuendos and fueled by press. So I don't know that technology is, in fact, it is more immediate. I'm not trying to say everything's the same and nothing has happened that's different. I'm just trying to say some of what we proclaim to be so different, I don't know whether or not it's as different as we are proclaiming it when you look at these things.
Yeah, I agree. And look, there are obviously times that were worse than this. World War I and World War II were bad in a way that right now, at least, isn't bad. At the same time, I'd say some of the bad times seem to have resulted from forces that have parallels today. So, for example, I think I would argue that the wars of religion that racked Europe for a long time had to do really a lot with the invention of the printing press, without which I don't see the Protestant Reformation unfolding to begin with the way it did, if at all, right? That was a case where a technology came along that decentralized power. All of a sudden, Martin Luther could just write an essay and put it up, and it might get picked up and published in cities around Europe, which happened. Up until then, the Catholic Church had basically a monopoly on the mass distribution of information. And, so it has happened before that rapid change in information technology had, really worrisome, effects. And I think to the extent that there are parallels there, we need to dwell on those.
And you're totally right about that. Meaning it's easier in the light of the past to go, oh, you know, big deal, like 1890s and Pulitzer journalism, but we fought a war and we occupied countries and we ended up in the Philippines for 30 years and running concentration camps. I mean, it wasn't all, whew, it's all fine. And you're right to point that out, that it may have come out in the end fine, but the end, there was a lot of harm done along the way, and we may be in the period of a lot of harm being done along the way with these technologies as well. And I do think, but back to what you said before, that there are ways in which the reactions are ineffective. So think about if a lot of the problem is the power of the presidency in a technological age. You could have, let's say you believe that, and let's say you think Trump is not a good custodian or steward of those powers that he did not create and that he was simply handed because he won an election. You could have tried to offset that differently than thinking that all we have to do is get rid of this person, or this person is the toxic substance, or this person is the issue. Because look, there are plenty of Republicans, even in 2017, who were somewhat more libertarian, distrustful of power historically, certainly distrustful of presidential power. We'll never know if this would have worked, but there might have been more of a coalition, not an anti-Trump coalition, but an anti-presidency coalition or a pro-congressional power coalition that you might have worked on more constructively to pare back powers without ever really going mano a mano, head to head with Trump and all of his foolishness.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree. First of all, Trump per se is not the problem, although I think it's urgent that he not be reelected because he's such a particularly alarming manifestation of the problem. But part of my point is he grows out of fundamental forces that are concerning and aren't going to magically disappear after he's gone. And I wouldn't want to sing the praises of globalization or capitalism to an extent that distracted attention from those byproducts of globalization and capitalism.
Yeah, but even there, like, I think some of our prescription or our description gets in the way of the right prescription. So even the now familiar, the greatest challenge now is income inequality, in my view, misses what that statement is actually pointing to, which is there are multiple people who cannot meet basic needs with any level of security that they will continue to be able to do so in the future. Either they can do so now, but they are legitimately concerned that they won't be able to do so in the future, or they can't do so now and they can't see any way they're going to be able to do so in the future as well. A lot of that could be accomplished without income becoming more equal or without any of those things. And a lot of those things could remain true with income inequality decreasing. So the idea that income is the means to solve those problems, I think, is false. And therefore, I think the degree to which we have settled into that as a truth risks policies that do nothing to alter those realities, i.e., how do you provide most people in affluent societies with sufficient security that their basic and not so basic needs, you know, entertainment, technology, access to the internet, those are kind of basic needs that aren't the same as food, clothing, and shelter, but they're real. That we, you know, this is why Andrew Yang's campaign is intriguing, right? Because he talks about universal basic income. Whether or not that's the right policy, it's intriguing in that he is pointing to what do you do to provide that in an affluent society. But simply making income less unequal will not in and of itself change any of those things. And so we've created a description of a problem that we've now focused, I guess, on addressing in a way that I think you could be legitimately concerned won't actually do much to address it at all, but it will certainly create more agitation.
Well, although I think even focusing on income inequality encourages you to say what you just said, which yeah, I think you'd say is a productive phenomenon.
Maybe, although I think many people were saying this 20 years ago as well. I mean, the whole point of the healthcare debate in the 1990s under the Clintons was we're failing to provide a basic need that an affluent society should somehow underwrite, right? And that was in a much less where income inequality wasn't even part of the discussion really in the 1990s, but that was part of the discussion. You know, how do we provide basic needs to people? And we started paring back on those long before income inequality itself became more yawning post 2008. And look, The Economist ran a really interesting package about a month ago about whether or not we're even measuring these things correctly. But what we're clearly not incorrect about is whether or not basic needs and security is being provided to enough people in affluent societies that ought to do it. That might be a better starting point than an income inequality, because it would address what people are actually agitated about. You know, they're not agitated about whether or not they have X income or Y income. They're agitated because, you know, even Y income doesn't provide that security.
Well, I think even separate from that, there's a relative status question. I mean, human beings do, social status matters to people, and correspondingly the amount of respect they feel they're getting, and so on.
Yes.
And the perception of huge disparities in income can itself be a problem, to the extent that people associate it with their just having very low relative status. And you know, it's relatedly, it plays out in, for example, the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
They're not wrong to say that, look, even if I have security, even if I know I'm not going to starve to death, even if I know I'm going to get decent health care, if it is the case that when my kid gets arrested for something, he has a much better chance of going to jail than a rich kid who gets arrested for the same thing, which is in fact the case.
Yep.
Then that's a problem in its own right, and it's a problem. You could try to correct the justice system in a way that would fix it by, you could make the justice system impervious to different, you know, to how much people pay for their lawyers. You could try that. It might work. But I don't think it's totally wrong to perceive that as a problem. That is related to income inequality, right? And so this is an example of the kind of thing that Steve Pinker didn't even mention in his book on income. Maybe in passing he touched on it, but he showed no real concern and no real understanding of the many implications.
Talking about criminal justice, because that's an area where you've had these really bizarre but somewhat effective coalitions of things like the Koch brothers foundations and progressive groups coming together around criminal justice reform, thinking, you know, basically taking what you just said and saying, whether it's because of the amount of money we spend incarcerating people, whether it's the degree to which we've criminalized behavior that used to be civil penalties or non-incarceratable, we have real problems, and it's falling hugely disproportionately on lower incomes as well as on African Americans and non-whites. Mm-hmm. And that's not tenable in a democracy, right? That erodes any notion of democratic comity and should be addressed. And yet you have these groups that would normally totally be at each other's throats, right? The Koch brothers on the one hand and progressive groups on the other, working together very effectively, whether it's things like the Bail Project and addressing New York and California, which were one of the only states left with bail, which was its own massive problem of you know, basically getting people into the system who then plead guilty to because they can't make bail. You know, that is a story of we are addressing some of those issues. We're doing it in a way that really cuts across predictable ideological lines and is an issue that we are addressing in a more pragmatic way, almost beneath the radar. I mean, it kind of goes back to, again, what you were saying of like, well, why does it matter? You know, why shouldn't you be hysterical about these things? And what good do you get by being more constructive? I'm suggesting that you end up attacking the wrong enemy or you end up focusing all your energies on a problem that is not in and of itself resolvable, but will only get worse, and then sacrificing the ability to actually change things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are pragmatic ways of going about these challenges, that being one there that, you know, I've just pointed out. I didn't create those coalitions, but there is criminal justice reform occurring. It's not being led by Washington. Washington is signing on to it, but it didn't stem from Congress. It didn't happen because a bunch of people got elected on that campaign. And I think we ought to be paying more attention to ways in which groups and individuals have addressed problems and solved them without adding fuel to them and then misdiagnosing them and generating the wrong solutions.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of left-right collaboration involving at least one Koch brother, And maybe this is, it'll steer us to the kind of the subject we started on, I guess, which is conflict, international armed conflict. One encouraging sign has, I think, has been there's a think tank in Washington that just was born recently called the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, supported by, I think, Charles is the brother, the Koch brother, and some money from George Soros's Open Societies thing, whatever that's currently called. It's very the good news is it's very anti-mindless militarism, and I think you're really seeing the importance of its voice right now as things heat up with Iran. And again, by the time people will watch or listen to this, things may have heated up even more. That's the good news. The bad news is they're still swimming against the tide, in my view. I mean, the term increasingly used for the Washington foreign policy establishment is the blob. I think it deserves a term at least that derisive. These are the people who, whether they're liberal interventionists or neocons, whatever, they have collectively, I think, gotten us into a number of wars and just mired us in endless conflict. I think not unrelated to this is I think maybe, and I swear, final plug for anything I've ever done, well, at least for this book, Non-Zero, I think in that book I use the term growing lethality of hatred, by which I meant there were two things going on. I mean, more and more the development of weapons technologies that might be hard to monitor could in principle be weapons, munitions could be created in secret, like biological weapons, especially. Yeah. That and the way information technology was allowing relatively small but intensely motivated groups,
sure,
to coordinate. And if those groups get a hold of those weapons, you got a problem. Now, it hasn't happened yet, but what I meant by the growing lethality of hatred is that we should take seriously the idea that whenever we generate hatred in the world, we may be doing something super ill-advised. So it may be that there was a time when you could invade a country, and if you conquered it, fine, in terms of long-term blowback. But I think you mentioned the last three presidents, they all had their issues here. Obama, I thought, much too promiscuously used drone strikes, which create anti-American hatred. Trump has followed along those lines with the drone strikes, even though he professes not to like armed military presence. George W. Bush is, of course, a legend when it comes to stupid military intervention. It just seems to me that we have a problem here that A, isn't being recognized by politicians, but B, I think when you assess the problem in the context of like human cognitive biases and how easy it seems to be to manipulate Americans into believing that, oh, this is the great Satan now. It used to be Iraq. Now it's Iran. I personally wonder whether anything short of a revolution, you know, both in a certain sense at the policy level, but also at the level of mindset, at the level, some kind of grassroots change in the way people process information, perhaps partly through growing awareness of these cognitive biases. Anyway, I'll stop now. And even if it's not yet clear what I mean, I'll just say that I think it may be the case that to avoid another major, major downturn, we need really some revolutionary developments.
Look, you're totally right that fewer and fewer people with the technologies of death are going to be able to do more and more harm. And that's been the trajectory for the past 60 or 70 years. What's astonishing about that is, this is like the cup half full, cup half empty question. Why isn't it happening more, right? All of us wondered, why didn't Al-Qaeda after 9/11 just dispatch a bunch of people with Uzis to shopping malls? Now, it wouldn't have been spectacular, and it wouldn't have been dramatic, and it wouldn't have had the photographic, phantasmagoric movie realism of 9/11, but it would have sowed fear, and it would have created martial law and all sorts of things in the United States that would have basically shut us down for X number of time, and maybe permanently. Who knows? So it's very hard to have a $700 billion a year military and not use it, just like it's very hard for hundreds of millions of Americans who are well-armed, for occasionally individuals who are angry and enraged, to just go shoot a bunch of people, which seems to be if not a daily, certainly a weekly occurrence. 3 people die here, 10 people die there, 15 people right. die here. And we are both inured to it, but we are also somewhat able to encapsulate it, meaning just like we've, you know, just like Brazil encapsulates a high murder rate and Mexico. These are bad things, but they're not civilizational ending things. Mm-hmm. Yes, if each of those individuals who shoots 2 people had a nuclear weapon, it would be civilizational ending if they used it. But what's extraordinary is, you know, you could flip that on its head and ask, why don't these things happen more given how easy it is for them to happen? As opposed to, this is suddenly, you know, one day it's going to get out of hand. I mean, Om Shiguro set off sarin gas in the subways of Tokyo. They were pretty sophisticated. It didn't work very well, by the way. You know, there was a mm-hmm. certain amount of luck and contingency. I don't know what to say to that, meaning it is always going to be possible, permanently.
Well, okay, then maybe I should say a little more to try to get you to say a little more. So you're right that the number of mass shootings has been finite. On the other hand, most of the ones committed in America by Muslims have reflected the trend I was describing. They have tended to be reactions generated by a hatred, in turn generated by American policy. They, in general, these people tend to cite American drone strikes, American troops. For example, the Pulse nightclub shooting, turns out that wasn't about a gay nightclub. It wasn't about Muslim attitudes toward gays. The guy didn't even know it was a gay nightclub.
Yeah, no,
the first thing he, let me just finish. The first thing he said when he called 9/11 was, get your troops out of A, B, and C, or drone strikes or something. That is a recurring theme. And all I want to say is, so we do, there is evidence that I'm not concerned without reason. The hatred we generate abroad does come back to haunt us. And you're right, it hasn't so far gone big time. But look, leave nukes aside. Biological weapons, I think, are the scariest thing going.
Yeah.
Chemical weapons aren't contagious. And even some biological weapons aren't. Even anthrax isn't contagious. But some are. And if you look at the way we overreacted to 9/11, 3,000 deaths. Imagine 30,000. Imagine 300,000. Imagine 3 million. It's like, unless the psychology of human beings changes and their ability to process information in the wake of trauma changes and their degree of kind of manipulability by warmongers changes, it's only going to take one to bring a global cataclysm, I think.
There's no question about that. The question is, what does one do with that?
Well, for example, get serious about international control of biological weapons. We can't do that so long as a guy like Trump is in the office. We weren't doing much about it during Obama's administration because of political forces at work. I'm saying there are certain kinds of existential problems that are foreseeable. It's possible to look at them and go, hey, we're not dealing with that at all. And if that sounds alarmist, my point is that then that's what we need, because people just aren't focused on this problem.
Well, I think governments are, I mean, national governments are pretty focused on the ones that have biologics, which is still a handful of countries, not multiple countries.
Yeah, but it's not just a government thing.
People having access to those.
Oh, we're doing, it only takes one country.
Yeah.
Where there's a lab student with a lab with one unsupervised grad student. I mean, it would have to be a reasonably sophisticated grad student, a pretty well endowed lab. Great. But all that stuff is growing. There's more and more smart grad students. There's more and more well endowed labs. We're not even thinking about the fact that, hey, you know, actually we have to make sure there's not even one country where this can happen because this stuff is so easy to transport. So I leave you on a note of alarm.
We have a lot more to talk about.
We do. I'll give you the last word on what if there's something else you want to talk about or an opinion you want to
share. You in your own work, whether it's non-zero, but also the work on Buddhism, are in a kind of a dialogue with yourself about
I'm glad somebody's listening.
How does one confront the world as it is, but not get completely lost in all of the potential hall of mirrors and threats and problems, which is kind of at the heart of a lot of Buddhism. I mean, Buddhism, from one perspective, is an amazing mechanism to calm oneself in the face of a storm, but it could also be criticized as an amazing mechanism to deny the storm and mm-hmm. retreat from it and abjure all responsibility for addressing its harm.
Meditation can be used that way. I would say it's being misused then, but it can be used that way.
No, I'm just, you know, these are, there's mm-hmm. pros and cons, or there are ways in which these things can be used and there are ways they can be misused. I am trying to point out in everything I do, and it's, I'm not sure it's effective or not, that we are in a cultural moment that is particularly fraught and particularly full of fear and attuned in an extremely sensitive way to all the things that could go wrong in ways that drown out all the ways in which things could go right. And given that we all have choices and bandwidth, the more you not following what might go right is not just an opportunity cost lost. It's a non-use of energies that could be more constructive. And reacting to threats is reactive. Creating a world where those threats are either more inert or a world where all these issues are addressed requires a lot of aggressively positive energy. And you know, I think in the United States, the 1950s, the 1930s, to some degree, the 1990s were some of the, you know, real moments of intense creativity. Mm-hmm. They were not in any way perfect moments in time. And I'm not suggesting that. But the tenor of those moments was a conviction that we are capable of coming together to solve problems. And I know that sounds unbelievably naive. Well,
so you're talking about the New Deal, for example?
Yeah, and I'm talking about the 50s, and I'm talking about the 90s and the kind of initial.
Right, but the New Deal was arguably motivated partly by actual fear.
Yes,
that there were so many alarmed people out there marching that they could tear the whole system apart. They were part of the energy.
A great softball, too. Look, that was Roosevelt's inaugural address in March of 1933, the famous, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, fear that precludes action. He went on to say that in that speech, mm-hmm. that it paralyzes our ability to act.
Well, no, but I would argue that the energy helped motivate
I'm just quoting Roosevelt's speech, right? He did actually say that.
He did say that.
That was part of the signature launching of that time.
Yeah, no, politicians never say, oh God, I'm freaked out by the prospect of revolution. I better do something. They don't talk that way in public. Well,
that's true. I mean, you could definitely push back on it for that reason. This is not, you know, I recognize this is not a fully resolvable debate, but it is a question of which we began with, you know, what do you gain or what do you lose? And mm-hmm. I'm suggesting that you lose a lot more than you think by laser-like focusing on all the things that are wrong and could go worse, and that we are at risk of unraveling ourselves. You know, we are at risk of talking ourselves into the sum of our fears rather than acting in a way that steers away from them. And you're saying, look, no, you need to stand on the soapbox and shout from the mountaintop that things are broken and getting worse in order to galvanize the energy mm-hmm. and the urgency to act now. And mm-hmm. I'm suggesting historically, I don't know that that's the case, and I don't see that being the case in the present.
But it's at least possible that those are a kind of a yin and yang, right? You wouldn't rule out the possibility that energy you perceive as negative, people on the soapbox screaming about the coming apocalypse, which I would say is a vocation I aspire to, that it's possible that from a certain perspective, they work hand in glove with the kinds of people you're talking about who come along with smiles on their faces and give TED Talks and say, we can do this, people.
You're totally right. I cannot rule out that they are both necessary components that each in and of itself is sufficiently imbalanced as to not provide a pathway that you need a little bit of both. But if you need a little bit of both, then I'm deeply worried that we are skewing entirely toward the soapbox and the coming apocalypse and not that there actually isn't enough of both right now.
Yeah. Well, I think what we can agree on, and by the way, I would say, as long as you mentioned my stuff on Buddhism, my assessment of the magnitude of the problem is that, you know, when you go on a meditation retreat, by the end of the retreat, if all goes well, you are such a different person from the one you were at the beginning. Sadly, it's hard to hang on to that kind of person you were at the end, but, and you can hang on to a fraction of it with daily meditation, maybe, but it's such a dramatic change. And when I look at how easy it is, again, for ordinary people, the way we are, just are ordinarily, by virtue of our consciousness, to be herded into support for a war or something. I sometimes think, man, we're really going to need, for a lot of people, to change in a fairly significant way in the direction of the kind of equanimity and judiciousness you may have at the end of a meditation retreat. And that's what I mean when I say that radical change may be in order, something dramatic at the psychological and or slash spiritual level. I do think one thing we can agree on is that our current anxieties are not being optimally allocated. I think a lot of the things that people are obsessed about, I would say either not worth worrying about, or you're worrying too much about it, just in the sense that you're taking worry away from a bigger problem, right? Worry is a finite resource. Or in the sense that you're so worried that we're not thinking clearly. I agree with all that stuff. And I think you and I agree that there are sometimes when worry is in order. I assume you say that. And that our worries are not being optimally allocated now.
I think on that, yes. That would be the minimal baseline of our agreement would be worries are not being optimally allocated.
So we end on a note of peace. Peace be with us.
Peace be upon you.
Peace be upon us. Yeah. Anything else we should plug? Where do you tweet? What's your Twitter handle?
Really creatively at Zachary Carabell.
Who would have dreamed?
I know. It took me a long time to come up with that. I hired a whole branding agency, and that's what we came up with.
That's what they're for. That's how they earn their money. And that's all straightforward spelling wise, right? It's K-A-R-A-B-E-L-L.
Yeah.
I'm at Robert Reiter, W-R-I-G-H-T-E-R. And then you've got this Progress Network thing coming, right? And you got some big names. It's not just people like me. You've got David Brooks.
I do. And there's like 50 people.
Jim Fallows, right? The aforementioned Jim Fallows.
Yeah.
And Debbie.
And.
Yeah. So this is big.
Jim Slaughter, Fareed Zakaria.
Fareed.
Pinker.
Oh.
Bina Venter.
So there is diversity here. And we look forward to seeing how this plays out. And I'm glad to be the equivalent on that to what you are on Fox Business News.
That's good.
And we can see you there too, and in many publications. So thanks for taking the time, Zachary. We should do this again sometime.
We should circle back.
Check in after we see whether the current source of concern is going to lead to the end of the world.
We can do the next one from the bunker.
Yeah, I'll be there, brother. Okay, thanks, Zachary.
Thank you, Robert.